Why is the word Shona repeated three times when really it should have said only once? At the end of the 127, it should have said Meyo Vesrim Vesheva Shoni. Why does it say Meyo Shono Vesrim Shono Vesheva Shoni? So the extra two times where it says the word Shona is difficult. Loimer Lo, the teacher used to call Nidrash Le'atzmoy. Each one has a different lesson. You know, so how many lessons are you going to say? You have two, because one you need anyway. So what is the lesson? Basku ke Bascho Lechek. When she was 100 years old, she was like 20 years old concerning sin. Ma Bascho Lechoto, that a 20-year-old doesn't sin. Sheharei Eino Bas Onshin, because a 20-year-old punished for her sins. Af Basku Veloichet, for sorrow, the Chiddush was that even when she was 100, she was in a state of Veloichet like she was when she was 20 years old. Ubascho Kebaz Zayen Leyoifi, and she was as beautiful when she was. This creates a lot of problems. First problem, when it says that the same way that she was sinless when she was 20 years old, she was sinless when she was 100 years old, that assumes that since, so you start counting sins when you are 20 years old. That's not correct. Bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah. When you become 13 years old, you are already a sinner. You know, the sin is considered a sin. What does Rashi mean? In Rashi's quoting Chazal, that when you become 20 years old, so you're sinless, because that's when you start sinning. That's it. That's the first question. Second question is, what's the point of telling me that when she was 100 years old, she was still clear from sin? Maybe she committed a sin when she was 101. Can't tell me, because she was, you know, she had a child when she was 90, she could have done something wrong when she was 101. What's the point of telling me that she was 100? She didn't commit a sin. She's 127 years to go. Here's the problem. Second problem is in the second part of Rashi. Baschov ke bat zayin liyoyfi. General, who says that a 20-year-old is considered less yoyfi than a 7-year-old? Was when she was 7, for sure she was beautiful. When she was 20 years old, she was as beautiful as she was 7. Doesn't make any sense at all. Because in order to make such a statement, it would only fit in like the first statement. The first statement is when she was 100 years old. Usually when a person is 100 years old, right? His records are full of sins, usually, right? 100 years of sinning, right? So many chances. By sorrow, she wasn't that way, right? Let's use that statement. You transfer the same idea here. 20-year-old woman. A 20-year-old woman is usually ugly. Sorrow was even, at 20 she was beautiful. I mean, who says that statistically when people are ugly when they are 20 years old? What's the idea behind it, right? So let's go back to the beginning. Number one, the first question. What does it mean that a person, before they are 20 years old, they are not, they don't, their sins are no sins, right? Even the statement itself doesn't make sense. What does Rashi mean? The proof that someone doesn't sin is because she wasn't punished. Just the opposite. The Gemara says that Dinei Shomayim, judgments from heaven, are not given until someone is 20 years old. Human courts punish after bar mitzvah. The courts of heaven, whatever that means, they punish after a person is 20 years old. So what does Rashi mean? Eino basoishin. Eino basoishin klapeshmayo. In heaven, but in here, she could be a sinner. So what does it mean? So maybe she committed sins before she was 20? What kind of a statement is it? Because she no basoishin. Eino basoishin doesn't mean that you're not a sinner. What Rashi means is the following. Usually we assume that when a person becomes bar mitzvah, he becomes an adult. He becomes responsible for his actions. That's a mistake. The real way of describing what bar mitzvah is that bar mitzvah is the beginning of the process of becoming responsible for your actions. Meaning it's not something that happens overnight. From one moment to the next, you become fully responsible for your actions. No, it doesn't happen that way. Becoming responsible for your actions is a whole cycle, it's a whole development that starts when you become, as an average, 13 years old. That's when you start sensing responsibility. But your responsibility, your maturity, doesn't develop fully, we assume, like all other cycles. You know what a basic cycle? A natural cycle usually is associated with what number? Number 7. Usually it's a number 7. 7 days, right? 7 weeks, right? 7 years, 7 times 7. The same thing is the cycle of maturity. The cycle of maturity starts at 13 usually, and it ends at 20. Okay? So what about if a person does commit a sin when he's 13, 14, 15? It's not a sin. Yes, but there is a major difference. Point is like this. You see, let me give an example. For instance, let's say someone, a child, 15 years old, he'll start using drugs, or he starts stealing. There is nothing that can tell me for sure that when he grows up, when he becomes a real adult, he won't say, come on, I'll stop all this nonsense, and that's it. So if so, you can't say that the sins that he committed are making, we're going to use the word, a sinner. He's not a sinner. He's a person that commits sins. If we define sinner as someone that by his very nature, that the sin penetrated his nature, it had been established into his character, that's what we are going to call a sinner. A person who sins isn't necessarily a sinner. We are going to define a sin as a mistake that you make. A sinner is someone that his mistake has penetrated his basic traits.
The Benoni and the Russia, the difference.
I'm just telling you, in general, whenever we talk about a person who has reached a level of a sinner, we are talking about not someone who has committed sins. A sinner is someone whose nature is reflected in his sins. In other words, his sins have penetrated his nature. Okay, now. Again, if a person commits a sin, he's 15 years old. Right? It doesn't say anything about what his personality will be like. It doesn't say anything. Because he isn't grown up yet. We have to wait till you are 20 to know whether that sin is a reflection of your very nature or is it just a mistake. So when does a person become a sinner? When he commits sins after 20, those sins may be serious enough to make him into a sinner.
How does that go along with Ben Sura Mora then?
Good. That's a basic question, but the Gemara asked the question. Right? The Gemara asked the question, I mean, you say from last week's Parsha, as a matter of fact. The question is last week's Parsha. Last week's parsha said that Ishmael was judged. Basher Husham, right? That you don't judge a person according to the future. If a sin is not a sin, right? You don't judge a person about the future. So how can you Benzer Moire? He's judged Al Shem Soifoi because eventually he'll become a murderer. I mean, how can you judge a person for what he's going to become? Let him become first, then you punish him, right? Good, so that's what, a lot has been said, that we once even spoke about it, the opinion in the Gemara says, Benzeru Moire lo yoga lo yohosit liyes. The whole parsha of Benzeru Moire is a warning to the parents. That what? That the parents have a tendency to say the other way. He's only a child. He's only 13 years old. Doesn't mean anything. That's what the tendency. You should know that if you do it when you are 13, it's possible that it's going to continue to the point that it will become part of his nature. It's a warning of the parents. The whole parsha of Benzer Moire is to teach you the opposite, that don't say, well, he's under 20. Until you are 20, you're not really an adult. So who knows when maybe when he's 20 he's going to become a Greek Rosh Hashiva. I mean, that's what your descendants is. Meanwhile, he steals wine and he steals the meat. But someday he'll become a big rabbi. Not necessarily. If you're not going to do something drastic, he will continue in this way, and eventually that will become his nature itself. Right? That is the whole idea of Ensor Moire. That you should know that the beginning of the process is when you are 13 years old. That is the teaching of Ensor Moire. It doesn't start when you are 20. Now, as we said before, then it's a cycle, right? So, really, it starts when you are born. When you're born, you have like basic feelings of responsibility, but it's not serious. Only it becomes a serious sense of responsibility when you are 13, and it's fully developed when you are 20. Now, listen to this Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Fifth Perek in Pirkei Avos. Hu hoyo oimer, Rav Yehuda ben Teima used to say the following. There is every trait or every characteristic that a person develops, there is a specific time for it. We'll see right away why he says that. Ben chomeshonim lemikro. A person develops a skill for learning chomesh when he's 5 years old. Ben eser lemishne. We're not going to go into all the details. There is an age when a person is ready to learn mishne. Before that, he's not ready. 10 years old is ready. Ben shloish esrei lemitzvos. A person becomes ready to do mitzvahs. He begins the sense of responsibility. Ben shmoin esrei lechupin, and so on and so forth. Okay? Goes on. When you're 30, this is the trait that's developed. When you're 40, then 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. Now I'm going to come to the last one. Listen to this. Ben meyo, a person who reaches the age of 100, it's an amazing, shocking statement that he makes. Ke'ilu meis, it's as if he's already dead. 100-year-old man. Ke'ilu meis. Ve'ovar u'potel min oilom. It's like, he's finished. Why would he make such a statement? It's more. You see, everything that Rabbi Yehuda ben Teima tells me, he has a purpose, there is a lesson. I have to know, when is the proper time to start teaching Chumash? So, okay, 5 years old. Mishnah. Getting married. What is he telling me concerning the 100-year-old? That when a person becomes a 100-year-old, just pick him up and throw him in the garbage? I mean, what is he telling me? What is the point of telling me that 100 years old, forget it. And then what? Right? Point is like this. What Rabbi Yehuda ben Teima is teaching you is the following idea, a very important idea. You know that usually we have an idealized age for a person, how long a person should live. An idealized age, right? Because we say it in our blessings. We bless each other with this, what? 120 years old. There are many reasons where that comes from, right? 120 years old, that is like a full life. Now, Rabbi Yehuda ben Teima tells me, if somebody has a full life, you should know that the same way that the beginning of the life is not sudden, a person doesn't suddenly become responsible for his actions. It takes 20 years to become fully responsible for your actions. At the end of the life, the process is equal but reversed. A person doesn't suddenly lose the sense of a responsibility. Rabbi Yehuda ben Teima is telling me that old age is a reversal of childhood. A person goes back to his childhood. In other words, don't say that this is a curse. No, that is the normal cycle of life. It takes 20 years old when you are responsible, and it takes 20 years to disappear, sort of. So when does the moment of the beginning of that disappearance come? When you're 100. That's the point. When you're 100, that is the beginning of the way down, of the disappearance of that level. Do you follow this idea? So this is what it's telling me. It's not telling me that you should know to throw him out because he's 100 years old. He's telling me you should know that's part of the process. That's a blessing. That's part of the process that when he becomes 100 years old, he starts losing some of that level of responsibility that he had it throughout his life. Some people reach the age of 100 when they become physically 100. Some people get it before, some people get it after. All he's telling you, it's an average of that idealized life. Okay? This is the idea behind it. Now, so what about if a person will commit a sin after he's 100? Can that make him into a sinner? Never. The same way that you can't become a sinner when you are 15, 16, 17 because you haven't reached the peak of your sense of responsibility. So therefore, you can't be judged according to those. Those actions are mistakes, but they don't reflect your essence because you haven't reached that point of absolute control of your essence. The same way that anything that happens after 100 is not considered something that affects your essence anymore. Your essence is finished. You hear this idea? Now, if so, if I can guarantee someone that between the age of 20 and 100 they won't become a sinner, then you can tell me for sure that what? They'll never be sinners. They may make mistakes, they may commit sins, but they will never be sinners. Okay? This is what Rashi is telling me. The same way, Rashi uses the word beloi chet. That doesn't mean beloi chet without mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. Sir also made mistakes. On the surface, you can ask the question, what do you mean beloi chet? I'll tell you at least one. Last week's portion, right? When she laughed, when she was told that that Yitzchok is going to be born, that's not a mistake. When she denies, right, the second, and when she denies, when she's presented with the facts, you laugh. No, I didn't. Good, whatever justification you're going to give, but on this, I mean, there are mistakes. And there are midrashi that even say that even though basically Sarah was right in what she did to Hagar and Ishmael, the way she went about it left a lot to be desired. There are midrashim that criticize Sarah for that. So she didn't make mistakes? Sure, Sarah made mistakes. All human beings make mistakes. Ain't tzadik boretz asher yaseh tov velo yeh. Everybody makes mistakes. But the mistakes of Sarah did never affect her essence. Her mistakes were the types of mistakes that somebody makes when they are 15 years old. Nothing. Sarah didn't make mistakes when she was 4 years old. Maybe she did. But all those mistakes don't change the essence of Sarah. She essentially remained absolutely pure. That is what Chazal are trying to tell you. She was as pure when she was 20 as she was 100. That's what we're concerned. Because after 100 and before 20, it never affects the purity. It's only a matter of making mistakes. All she did was make mistakes. It never affected her essence. Yeah.
She was 90, wasn't she? Was she when this happened?
Fine. That means that itself is the chidush. That all those mistakes that you might find in Sarah when she was 40, 50, 90, 99 are all mistakes. They are never something which affect her essence. That in itself is the lesson. Here? In other words, if you find in the Torah cases where you can say, here, Sarah did commit a sin, you should know it's only superficial sins. It doesn't really affect her essence. It's like a sin before 20 and after 100, even though she might have been 90, if you understand. But we are talking about the quality of that sin of 90. It's the type of a sin that doesn't affect her essence. Okay? Now, if you take a look at the Midrash Rabbah, it says like this. Right in the beginning of the parsha, Vayichaye Soro, etc., Omar Rabbi Yochanan, says Rabbi Yochanan, we can compare the life of Soro, Kehado Ekleso Temimto, like this innocent cat. Like a young cow, calf, like a very young cow. So the commentary, what is Rabbi Yochanan telling me that you can compare the life of Sarah like a who? Eglesot, hado, eglesot minto. So the Mefarshim say, what's an eglesot? Like a young calf jumps around And out of her innocence, sometimes she breaks things. But she's still innocent. Doesn't mean that she's a damaging animal. That is what Rabbi Yochanan meant. That the whole point of the Torah is to tell you that the mistake that Sorrow might have made did not affect her essence. She was as tummy, as pure, while she was committing her sins, as if she wouldn't have committed any sins at all. Okay? In other words, the point of the Rashi is to show you her innocence, yeah?
Sorry, I've got a problem though on that. Well, what about Moshe? Moshe also didn't affect his essence when he committed sins.
Right, right. Because the sins of sorrow might have been misunderstood as sins that show corruption of character. That's the problem. By Moshe, we never have such a problem that the Torah has to clarify. You should know that there is nothing essentially wrong. By sorrow, we have a reason. Because somebody may say, look, she lacked faith in God when she laughed. Lack of faith is a flaw in essence, right? The way she treated Hagar and Ishmael, then some people may say that is a corruption. So the Torah has to clarify, no, you are wrong. It's only, could be a mistake, could be not, but it's all superficial. Essentially, she was the purest of women that ever lived. And in order to stress the point, it tells you the second point too. There is a beauty of a 7-year-old and there is a beauty of a 20-year-old. There is a basic difference. It doesn't mean that a 20-year-old is ugly and a 7-year-old is beautiful. That's not what the assumption is. The assumption is that a 7-year-old, that is the last point that a girl can be beautiful without even being aware of it. It's like a natural, pure beauty that doesn't affect her nature. When someone is 20 years old and she's beautiful, the chances of her affecting her nature and becoming corrupt because of the physical, her physical appearance, are extremely great. That's when it's the greatest at 20 years old. Okay? In other words, there is a beauty that's innocent, which means it's a beauty without self-awareness, and there is a beauty that corrupts. 20 years old is usually the age when beauty corrupts, and 7 years old is the example of beauty that's innocent, that's pure. What is the Torah telling you here? Even the beauty that was so great that the Gemara says that we are talking about one of the 4 most beautiful women that ever lived, says the Gemara Megillah. Right? Even in a 20, probably she was at the peak of her beauty, probably. Even at that point, it didn't affect her. So if her beauty didn't affect her, can you imagine what purity there was in her character? That stresses the point that any mistake she might have made does not affect her essence at all. If her beauty could affect her essence, which is something so natural and it's so very few people can overcome it. She did. So you can imagine that there was no corruption whatsoever. Anything that you may derive from certain actions that she did from the Torah, that she laughed at when the Malach said and the way she treated Hagar, it's only superficially she made mistakes. It did not affect her essence at all. She was pure through and through. That is the whole purpose of the Torah. That is the purpose of telling you this text. Now, Pasuk 2. Vatomo Soro Bekiryas Arba hi Hebron. And Soro died. Bereshna. Vayovoy Avromo Lispoit le Soro Velipkoisoi. And Avromo Vinu came to eulogize, to make a hesped for Sorrow and to cry for her. There's a famous question. The order is wrong. The eulogy comes second. First comes the crying and then comes the eulogy. So there's a traditional answer that's given that for a tzaddik, that the crying comes from the understanding of what the person did through the life, through her lifetime. So the more you eulogize, the deeper you feel the loss. For someone who didn't do anything, you just liked the person, the crying precedes the eulogy. For someone that did so many things during her lifetime, then you need the eulogy to awaken the feeling of loss. This is why, by a great tzaddik, that's what it says. First comes lispoi, the eulogy, and then lifkoisho. That's one answer. There's another problem, and this is the hint that the Torah is trying to tell you something. In the word velif koisho, there is a small chof. You see the small chof? Also, that indicates something. What is it? So the Balaturim says, if you take a look, the Balaturim says, well, if it says a small chof, when sometimes the Torah writes larger letters than normal and smaller letters than normal. When the Torah writes smaller letters, it seems to tell you that something less happened than what should have happened. So what happened less? That Avram cried less than what we would expect. You hear? That is a small chof. In other words, the base was normal and then it shrank to a small chof. That reflects the type of crying again. Requires an explanation. What is the Torah telling you? Why would he cry less? Okay. Then, added to this, there is another problem that on the surface has nothing to do with this, but I think this I haven't seen that people ask, but I think there is no question about it that it requires an explanation. If you take a look in Rashi, the third Rashi in Pasuk Bet, it says like this, Lispoit lesoro velip koiso. Okay? Says Rashi, Nismecho misa soro l'akeda sitzok, the reason why the Torah writes together the akeda sitzok and the death of soro, lefishe al yedei besuras akeido, because one caused the other. It was because of the besuras akeido. Rashi hints to the Chazal, what? That the Soton came to soro and told her, you know what? Your husband is ready to sacrifice the son, or was ready to sacrifice your son, and he didn't finish the statement, but God didn't allow it, or God told him not to, and she died. That's what Rashi wrote. Ukimat sheloi nishchat porcho nishmoso mimenu umeiso, then she died. Okay, fine. So Rashi is giving a reason why the Misa Soro is right next to the Pasha Sakei. But I want to know a technical question. I want to know, where should Rashi, you know, the Divrei HaMaskel, Rashi has two parts always, the Divrei HaMaskel, which means the quote from the Torah, and then starts Rashi's interpretation or addition to what the Torah says. Okay? And always what Rashi says relates to the Divrei HaMaskel, to the words that he quotes, right? This is the regular procedure. Like in the beginning, so and so. You know, there's always a Divrei HaMaskel, a quote, interpretation. Quote, interpretation. So I'm asking you, if Rashi wanted to tell me that the reason why Akedah Sitzok is next to the death of Soro is because this and this and this reason, what should be the quote from the Torah? What should be the Divrei HaMaskel?
Rayam what's on it?
For Tomos Soro, 100%! You know, where it says, Vatomos Soro, Rashi should have said, Lomo nismecho misa soro lakeda sitzchot, because one caused the other. That's a simple technical question. Where does Rashi say that? Lomo nismecho? On the words, lispoit lesoro velipkoiso? Why does he wait till now? Right? It seems like a nothing question. But it's very significant. Rashi doesn't do this kind of thing. There must be a reason. Unless it's a printer's mistake. That happens. Sometimes. But here it's very unusual, because even the order would be wrong then. A printer took it out and added another. Why would he do such a thing? The chances are that that's the way Rashi puts it. So then the question is, why? Why didn't he say it in the beginning? Vatomo soro lomo nismecho. And then he should have said, Vayobo Yavrom. That should be the normal thing. So, in order to get everything straight, let me tell you what I found. I found it in a sefer that I've just received this year. It's called Kehiloi Sitzok. Beautiful sefer on Chumash. And it says a principle, a very important idea. And according to this idea, it will really answer. He doesn't say it to Rashi, but it definitely would fit perfectly in Rashi. He starts with another problem. he doesn't understand the sota. He says like this, the sota's job is always for the good, as a challenge to someone to do good. That's the purpose of the sota. The sota for us is not a shoyne Hashem, an enemy of Hashem, chas v'shalom. Just the opposite. He works with Hashem in a roundabout way. Other malachim work for Hashem directly. He does indirect things for Hashem. To serve as a challenge to someone that he should be overcome, and the overcoming is good. That is the job of the sota. This is what Chazal mean. Remember with the Chazal that say that in the Yom HaShishi, he saw the creation of man, Vayar, and Hashem saw Kitoyv Me'oid. It's very good. And you know that we have a klal, who has Soton, who has Malchamoves, who has Yetzer Hora. All the negative powers in the world are all one. Who Malchamoves, Soton, Yetzer, it's all one. So it says like this. Toiv is the Yetzer Toiv. Me'oid, very good. Zeha Yetzer Hora, it says. What do you mean? How can Toiv Me'oid be Yetzer Hora? Simple, says the Maral. Because the whole idea of Toiv Me'oid tells you that whatever your level of Toiv, you can reach a higher level. Toiv, Toiv Me'oid. Any level you are, there can be a better level. Now, what differentiates between the different levels of Toiv? How can there be a difference between Toiv and Toiv Me'oid and very, very good? There must be something which is not the opposite of good in order for the next level to be a purer level of good. What is something which is not good? Bad, evil, ra. Comes out according to this that the purpose of the Yetzer Hara is to make from Toiv, Toiv Me'oid, to serve as a challenge in order that you should constantly rise and eventually reach your level of fulfillment. In other words, the purpose of the Sota is always for the good in the long run. All of a sudden, we find the Sota with a different job. His job is to take revenge on Avram, it sounds like. Or to take revenge. Because the Midrash says, if I brought the Yalkut Shimon, if I got the wrong one, in the Yalkut Shimon is an amazing description of Avram Avinu's trip to Haram Eiriyah. Every step of the way, the Sota comes and tries with every trick in the book to stop him from going to sacrifice his son. And Avram keeps overcoming the Sota, overcoming the Sota, overcoming the Sota, and he won. So it sounds like, oh, now the Sota, when he saw that he was overcome, now I'll get back at him. Nekoma, getting back, is not one of the traits of the Sota. That's what bothers him. That's the question of this Kehillah Sitzchak. And he says, therefore, there is here another very important principle that Chazal are telling us, and the principle is the following. We usually think that our test of something is always before we complete the mitzvah, right? Or before we do something good. That's when the test is, right? For instance, we were offered something delicious which is not kosher. And we had a tremendous desire to eat, a tremendous desire. Overcame it, didn't eat it. Oh, sure, that's it, we're safe. Not safe, not safe at all. Why? Because the Gemara says that there is a concept called Toye al Horishoinois. Let's say, after you were offered the delicious food, you rejected it. And an hour later, you get hungry and you say, oh boy, why did I reject it? I wish I would have eaten it. It says in the Gemara that all the merits that you got for doing the mitzvah are lost retroactively because this is reversed tshuva. Toya lo rishoynes is reversed tshuva, the same way that a person can do averis. And at the end he does tshuva, everything retroactively is made good, the same way the other way around. If you do good and then at the end you say, I wish I wouldn't, everything is erased. All the good is erased. It's like a reverse Jubit. Toya, as the Gemara says, Toya lo rishoynes.
Just by your thoughts.
What?
Just by your thoughts.
Well, it's not only the thoughts. You see, it's a commitment to a reverse. I gave examples of there was someone that was a yeshiva bocher till he was, I don't know, 15, 20 years old, and then he became a socialist, and now he's a writer. So he just can't, like, he can't say enough how much he regrets all the wasted years. Now it's like a commitment. It has to be more than just thought, probably. It's like, although tshuva is just the thought, right? But here also, but it has to be a thought that's expressed in action. I mean, he has to show his regret.
He
regrets that he wasted 20 years of his life learning Torah. That's Toya Lo Rishayno. In other words, he's actually an erasure of all the good that you did. Okay? Therefore, the test of that food that you didn't eat is not only before you eat it. After you eat it, the test is, will you ever regret it? You hear this? Therefore, the same way the Sotan worked on Avraham Avinu before the Akedah, right, to get him not to offer Yitzchak, the Sotan didn't give up. After the Akedah, he has a second purpose, to get Yitzchak to regret that he accepted us, that he agreed to offer his son. So the Sotan has a brilliant idea. You know what he's going to do? He is going to kill Sarah. How? By telling her this. The Sotan knows well how to get Sarah, right? That's his job, that's his profession. He knows, if he says, Avraham Avinu agreed to offer your son, she won't be able to take it. What will happen to Avraham Avinu once he finds out that because of his agreement to offer his son, right, she, the woman that he, do no question about it, he loves her, right? And all of a sudden he comes home and she's not there. What is now the test?
Not to regret it.
That even for a specific, that the thought of regret shouldn't cross his mind. Because if the thought of regret crosses his mind, then it's like a toya la rishonis. Now, what would have happened, says the Kiles Yitzchak, if Avraham Avinu would have cried for sorrow openly? What is expected from a husband that loved his wife, right? That, what would people think? Or what would the action, what could it have been perceived as? A regret. Oy, it hurts him so much, the death of sorrow. In order to make sure that it's not even understood as a possible regret, he made the small chok. You know, the crying was made smaller to fit the circumstances, to make sure that nobody even suspects that he regrets it. Okay? Comes out, according to this, that the reason why the chok is a small chok is because Avraham Avinu intentionally made the crying smaller to make sure that no one even has the thought that he regrets that the Akedah. The Akedah is 100% content that he did the right thing. He's satisfied that he did the right thing. Okay? Now, according to this, okay, if I were to ask you, that's what Liv Koiso comes to teach me. Right? Now, where is the right place for Rashi to tell you the story of the Sotan? According to this Yisoid of the Kehilo Yitzchak, that the whole job of the Sotan was to get him to do what? To cry loudly at the funeral, that it should show a partial regret. That was the purpose. So where is the most important part that Rashi should have hinted to this idea? In which part of the pasuk? Not in the dying of sorrow, in the crying. So take a look, where does Rashi tell you the story? By the crying, not by the vatomo sorrow. Because the main purpose of the Sotan was, when he will cry, that's when the regret will happen. That answers Rashi. That's the reason why Rashi said it after Liv Koiso and not after vatomo sorrow. And this answers the question, the job of the Sotan. You see, the question was, but the Sotan is just to take revenge, is just someone is going to take revenge. Not at all. The whole purpose of the Sotan of killing Sorrow was just as a test for Avraham Avinu. Will he still be strong in his decision to offer Yitzchak, or will he regret it? Okay? Now, comes out really that Sorrow served Avraham Avinu not only in her lifetime, but even the death of Sorrow has a meaning in the test of Avraham Avinu. Now, that's death of sorrow is part of the test of Akedat Yitzchak. That is like what finishes the tests of Avraham Avinu. You know that of the 10 tests of Avraham Avinu, Akedat Yitzchak is the last one, the one that establishes Avraham Avinu as he is. The last part of the test of the Akedo is the death of sorrow. That itself is the test of the Akedo. The death of sorrow, will it make him regret the Akedo or not? That is the final test of the Akedo. And that's when Avraham overcame it at the death of sorrow. Now, the Amek Dovor says just one more insight. He says like this. Why is it really that sorrow dies? How does it fit that when sorrow hears that her husband offered her son, that she couldn't take it, and she dies? Why? I mean, does it show? What does it show concerning sorrow? You know, it says in Chazal, there are many Chazal saying like the relationship between Avraham and sorrow is like the relationship of a neshama and a guf. A neshama and a guf create one unit. But Avraham is like the neshama of that unit, and sorrow is the guf. We find, for instance, the decisions of what to do in this physical world is usually the guf. Sorrow made the decisions of what to do with Ishmael. Right? That was the relationship of Avraham and sorrow. Sorrow was the more physical, the one that was involved in more physical things, and Avraham Avinu was more involved in spiritual things. That was the relationship. We can also understand, you know, the Chazal say a very interesting thing, that where did the Yud of sorrow go? Didn't get lost, the Yud of sorrow. Why? She became a Hey, like Avraham Avinu. Hey, right? Sorrow. But where did the Yud go? It's interesting, you know what the Chazal say, where did the Yud go? Yoshua Binu. Right? Yoshua Binu. Now, what's the connection between Yeshua bin Nun and sorrow? They're the same thing, you see. Moshe Rabbeinu and Yeshua bin Nun, right? We know that Moshe Rabbeinu, it wasn't shaya for him to fight Amalek. It wasn't shaya, it wasn't his level. To fight Amalek on the field, you need somebody whose characteristics are more physical. It's Amalek, the physical, the material world. He can stand on top of the mountain and pray. But the actual fighting, it has to be Yoshua. This is why it says like this. If the Moshe Rabbeinu would have brought the Jews into Eretz Yisrael, the coming into Eretz Yisrael would have been as supernatural as the leaving of Egypt. That's what it says. If the coming into Eretz Yisrael couldn't be supernatural, it has to be a physical, like, you know, step by step, conquering city after city. It can't be Moshe Rabbeinu. It has to be Yehoshua, right? Yehoshua from which Shevet? Yosef. Why? Because that is the nature of Yosef. This is, you know, it says Moshiach ben Yosef as opposed to Moshiach ben David. Moshiach ben Yosef means the physical redemption of the Jewish people. Because Yosef is the mashbir, the one that supports the other brother, the one that gives food. The symbolism of Yosef is physical support. Yehoshua is a great person, but in the physical level, down to earth. Moshe Rabbeinu is on top of the mountain. As long as the life of the Jews is on top of the mountain, then Moshe can lead them. As soon as it comes down to earth, it has to be Yoshua. Okay? So that's the meaning. The Yud of sorrow, you know, a Yud, a little bit of sorrow, came over to Yoshua, and that's the greatness of Yoshua, that he was good. In that second level, it's also part of being Jewish. There is an Avraham level, but there is a Yoshua level, there is a sorrow level. Okay? The sacrifice of Yitzchok, right? As we said before, that's the highest level of Avraham Avinu. So, by the very nature of the test, it's a test that only Avraham Avinu can reach. That was for that level of actually being able to sacrifice everything in the world for Hashem, that you need a level of Avraham Avinu. The level of sorrow was just to attach herself to Avraham Avinu. She would have had to make the decision. She couldn't make the decision. Because even though, like the Mefarshim say, afterwards, once Avraham Avinu establishes the capacity of self-sacrifice, then every Jew gets a little bit from Avraham Avinu. But in the beginning, it was a trait that only Avraham has and not sorrow. That is the essential difference. Sora is down to earth. She's down here. Abramovich is up there. This is why when the Sotom transferred the test of the Akedah to Sora, she couldn't take it. It wasn't from this world. She had to leave this world to be able to take the test. That leaving of the world, that's the death of Sora. Now, Sora by dying is able to accept the Akedah. As long as she's alive down to earth, she can't accept it. In other words, she also passed the test, but she couldn't stay alive. Abramovinu passed the test and still remained alive, meaning Abramovinu can be down here and still be up there in heaven. By Sora, as long as she's down here, she can't accept the offering of Yitzhak. She has to actually leave this world to pass the test. So the death of Sora is her way of passing the test. Okay.
How do you know she passes the test?
Again?
How do you know she passes the test?
Because we don't hear her saying, I wish you wouldn't have done it. We don't hear her saying. Her reaction is death. Her reaction is not say, oh no, no. The reaction is death.
How come if Sarah was more into this world, how come her prophecy level was higher than...
The Amidor talks about it. Over there, right over there.